Welcome back. So we'll get into some actual reasonings today, I hope, here. This has all been prelude, the first four classes. And interestingly, we probably won't even get to Nagarjuna today. But we'll see. This is all, of course, this is all a prelude and a long explanation of the first verse of chapter 18 of Nagarjuna. I just want to bring up this image that maybe I brought up in the last Nagarjuna class, but for me it's a kind of potent metaphor for the function of this kind of study, and that's like the image of, say, when you're a little kid and you think that there's a monster under the bed. You've heard this one? Mm-hmm. Or I think there's a children book called There's a Nightmare in My Closet.
Mm-hmm. Good story.
Yeah, it's a good story. Good story. And well illustrated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because I think this is a common thing for kids, right? I remember this feeling of, like, I think there's something in there at night in the dark, right? In the storybook, there really was, like, a 3D nightmare, right? It came out and he eventually befriended him.
That's what they do.
That's what they do, yeah. Yeah. Still a little scary to read it, I think.
Is this required reading?
There's a nightmare in my closet. It might be inspirational. But we have that feeling, and this is kind of my memory, vague memory of being a kid, and thinking, like, I think there's, like, a monster under the bed, or somewhere in the room. I just have this very uneasy feeling, and you know, cry or something. Mom comes in and says, "Don't worry, there's no monster." I'm like, "What do you mean there's no monster?" Like, we don't quite believe her. So she's like, "Okay, come down off the bed now. Let me show you. I'm not gonna look under the bed. No, like, I'll look first. You know." She looks first. There's no monster. Come, really? And she pulls you down and you're going, okay, and you like. Your understanding shifts when you look under the bed and you see that it's not there. But it's probably somewhere. Let's look the closet. And you check, like, all the possible places where the monster could be hiding. And in other words, it's not good enough for your mom to say, mm-hmm. Just trust me, there's no monster. You have to investigate yourself. And you have to check every possible place it could be. Because, you know, you check all the closets in bed, and then mom leaves, and then, oh, but there's still, like, behind that desk. We didn't look there. So, but if you really covered every possible place, and maybe while you're covering these other ones, you're making sure that it's not moving around behind you to, you know, escaping your view. And that when you finally see that it's not there, you really change, right? Your fear dissipates. I think there's also this experience, like, there's still sometimes that lingering thing, maybe like the adrenaline or some, you know, if we were really scared before, we can still see that it's not there, and we're kind of cognitively convinced that it's not there, but there's still maybe like, we're starting to relax. The body still hasn't quite caught up. And I think all of these, in all these aspects of this metaphor apply to this kind of reasoning, and they sometimes bring it up, this type of thing. In other words, if somebody says all dharmas are marked by emptiness, they neither arise nor cease, are neither tainted nor pure, and all this, right? It's still pretty nice to hear it, and it's somewhat relieving to hear it, and the more we understand it, the more we resonate with it. But we're not completely convinced, right? It's like, it sounds good, but like, everything is completely empty of any substantial existence from its own side. It's all dependent on mere imputation in order to even arise as an object. You know, someone can tell us that, like me, I can say that. And you might say, that sounds kind of cool. I'm open to the idea. I'm open to thinking about it. But we don't feel like, you know, our hair might not start to stand on end, right? We might not feel like, wait a second, my whole like worldview is being threatened, which is kind of too bad. We don't. But so there's a lot of teachings that say everything's empty, but then this particular gift of Nagarjuna and this kind of Madhyamaka reasoning in particular is it's like checking all the possible places where inherent existence might be hiding, the monster. And it is kind of a monster, this, you know, the belief that there's inherent existence hiding somewhere, because it's monster and that it's kind of harmful, that belief creates harm. But if somebody says there is no inherent existence of anything, it doesn't really work usually without investigating really thoroughly all the places it could be if it were to exist. So that's the, does that make sense? It's like why we would, you know, why we would want to like analytically investigate all these places it could exist. And again, just to mention that as it sounds kind of analytical and conceptual, and especially in Zen tradition, you say, well, isn't this going like the opposite direction from Zen practice of just like letting go of all our thinking and conceptualization? So this is not the end of the story, this conceptual investigation. It's kind of a step to convince the conceptual mind, basically. And that, you know, if we really can come to this clear conceptual conviction that we can't find inherent independent existence, then we bring that into a non-conceptual meditation. That's the kind of classical presentation.
You heard me. Well, actually, no. I just had a kind of opening awareness because it's the conceptual mind that clings.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good way to put it.
Thing. And those of us who, I know emptiness. Yeah, sure. Mm. But we still cling. Mm. And so it's like the evidence. I mean, the expression. How should I say this? If the behavior hasn't changed, then no matter how much you say you understand emptiness, you don't.
Mm. Although there's also, I think in general, that's a good point. And just as with the, I like added in this little part to this metaphor about the monster under the bed, and that even as a kid, you've checked it all out, but still there's this emotional lingering, adrenaline-based fear that we know it's completely irrational fear, but it might be enough to keep our behavior being like, we hear a little sign and we jump and like, well, I know there's no monster.
Yeah.
So that, I think, applies to this case too, of like, we can be convinced conceptually, and even, this is again the classical story in Buddhism, is that we can even have a direct non-conceptual realization of emptiness, and still our habit patterns are so deep that it's not going to change them overnight.
Sure.
Now, for Shakyamuni Buddha, one story is maybe it did change for him, like the moment of his awakening. He was so primed for that from like lifetimes and lifetimes of practice that like he went through all these stages of what we call the path of familiarization, which is usually after this direct realization of emptiness, then there's becoming familiar with it and applying it to all our neuroses for like eons until we're like completely Buddhahood. So for the Buddha, maybe that happened like all in one instant.
That story of the kid is a good analogy, but there's also the model part of it, which is the mother didn't logically refute every possible place where the monster could be.
Well,
the child actually, in the model, went under and looked and did the physical thing associated with that. And what I find is that there can be a lot of theoretical talk, but when the physical world actually affects our skandhas, boom, then it's necessary to invoke some kind of a check valve to say, okay, let me look at this. And that's what I find the Nagarjuna helpful, because when something unexpected happens, I can then say, pause, and while I'm metabolizing, I can then keep myself from writing a narrative or planning or doing something like that.
Uh-huh. Well, we can do it any time. That's when it applies most helpfully, I think, mm-hmm. is when we're suffering or under stress or something, is when we can, when it's most relieves our suffering. But I think because this particular method of Nagarjuna is pretty challenging to, you know, understand and work through it all, if we haven't worked through it when we're not really stressed, we probably won't be able to do it at that time. So that's why it's nice to, when we're like really relaxed and at ease, work through it and get more and more familiar in easy situations, and then start bringing it into the more and more challenging ones. You know, it's hard to just immediately leap to the really challenging ones. But I agree, that's when it applies the most. That's when it's most helpful. We might think, well, now it doesn't bother me so much that the floor really exists. That doesn't seem to be creating so much suffering. And I agree. But if we can start to understand more and more deeply how the floor doesn't substantially, inherently exist the way we think it does, then that application to our difficulties can really happen. So in the metaphor again, you might say, well, what if the monster is like paper thin and under the rug or something like that? But as a metaphor, it's like, and as a kid, it kind of worked. Like, I didn't think that it could be under the rug. I'm like, if you know, I'm convinced that it's at least this big or something, say. So like, if I looked in every place it could be, that's this big. As a kid, I'm pretty convinced. But Nagarjuna actually goes further than that. According to logic, or then that's the setup here, is we're going to look for every possible place. Like, there's going to be no corners are left untouched. In a pretty simple way, through logic, you can cover all the corners. And that's where we were left off last week, is if the self, or the floor, or anything, but we're talking about the self of the person, inherently exists, if it were to inherently exist, it would have to be the same as, exactly identical to, the body and mind, or completely separate from the body and mind. So in a way, there's only two closets in this room.
Two corners.
Yeah. Now, that's actually it. And according to, and you might have to think about that for a while to understand how there can't be any other corners in terms of that logic. It's like, it's either this or this. If it were to inherently exist, it's got to be this way or this way. There's no middle ground for inherently existent self. Now, there are expansions. So here it's going to be a five-cornered room, five-closeted room. And Chandrakirti's classical commentary has this seven-point reasoning, and I thought just to simplify it, because Nagarjuna's chapter doesn't go into these five or the seven. He just keeps it at two. But I think to expand it to five, and actually the Buddha, in the early Pali Sutras, the Buddha uses these five. I think he never uses seven. So it's an ancient reasoning. But what we'll see as we go through these, that the five are just expansions of the two. It's really, there's just these two positions where if something were to inherently, independently exist from its own side, in and of itself, independent of mind even, like be there. And we're not talking just about permanence either. Remember, now we're talking about even if it's arising and ceasing, for the moment that it's arisen, it exists in and of itself. That's what we're trying to refute. We're going to examine whether anything can be that way. If it were to be that way, it would have to be, if we're talking about the self of the person, it would have to be identical to body and mind, our body and mind experience, which may be a possibility, we're going to look, or it would have to be completely separate from body and mind. Because if it were something in between, identity and difference, it would be like dependent. It would be kind of like interdependent on body and mind, which we might find is what's going to be the case. But if it were to be somehow in some interdependent relationship with body and mind, then it's not independent self anymore.
So
this is starting to sound familiar now. So, might say, well, yeah, everything's interdependent, and what we're looking for is an independent self. And again, going back even further to these first steps, we might say, well, I've heard again and again everything is interdependent, and I totally grok that, and I agree. And yet, when it comes right down to it, especially we're talking about very subtle kind of independent existence, you might feel like, yeah, I don't believe that this paper independently exists. I know it's dependent on, for example, the tree, right? These are the easy ways to look at how it's interdependent. Depend on the tree and the ink and the printer and the paper cutter and all those things. So we can understand that and then in some degree understand that it's interdependent on those things. But to say, if we talk about independence as existing in and of itself, independent of particularly our mental imputations of it, like it exists whether or not I call it a paper or perceive it as a piece of paper, it really is a piece of paper. Like that's the kind of inherent independent existence that we're talking about here that's much harder to see, right? And I think even if we, and the irony is even if we go through these reasonings and get more and more familiar and convinced that it actually doesn't exist independent of the mind perceiving it, for example, it still seems to. It still is like, this is where we have this cognitive dissonance thing. You can get like the cognition can be completely convinced and still like, but, like, I think last week, it's here behind my back now. Like, I know exactly what it looks like, too. And like, but it's completely a mental projection right now. And even this is just a visual thing. So, anyway, in order to go through this, I'm sure we could spend a whole other day talking about this neither the same nor different point, because it's important to really get that. But I think if you get the general gist of it, maybe it'll be more clear as we go through the reasonings too. But that would be the first step. Well, again, reviewing, the very first step in this process would be like getting the real strong sense of the independent self as an actual experience, not as a theoretical thing of like, I'm told that I believe in an independent self, more like what, like imagine being falsely accused, right? Like, but I didn't, that's not just a mental projection, that's like me at its core, that one, that we feel like exists in and of itself, like the quality of me-ness, the self, selfness, the true Kokyo, right? There's somebody really here. It's not just a mental construction. So getting a sense for that, then the next step would be then coming to the conclusion that if that self exists in the way that it appears, in the way that it seems to exist in and of itself, it would have to be identical to this body-mind experience, which it seems like, well, maybe that is true, because it's something very closely connected with this body-mind, or it would have to be separate. And maybe not like across the room separate, but like slightly removed, like a witness looking down on my body and mind, or the owner of my body and mind, or something like that. But it would have to be completely unrelated and separate from. That's the second step. Now if we're convinced that it's in one of these two places, identical to body and mind or separate, then now we go into the reasoning. Also, just to mention still about this sameness difference thing, let me just bring up one more example, because the self and the person and the body and mind thing, the whole thing is very subtle and mysterious, who we are, right? So often, like Chandrakirti, the classical person doing this, talked about it He's talking about the self, actually, but he brought up a material example because it's easier. So his thing is a cart, or modern times they say a car. But you could use any object, like a chair is a good one because we have one here. The thing and its parts. A car is kind of nice because it's more complicated, like a person's more complicated, but a chair is pretty good. There seems to be a chair existing here in and of itself, doesn't there? Like a chair, and it has a chairness. It has this quality of chairness, and it's like we don't really argue that it's a chair. Like it really seems to be a chair. That's like how we view it. You know, our first take on it is it seems to be. That's what we would call an inherently existing chair, a chair that exists like from its own side. We know it's made by people and it's not permanent and it wasn't always here, but right now, there it is. Ta-da! Chair! But actually, now we can look at, so now we have, that's like an, you know, so-called independently, inherently, essentially, intrinsically existent chair. Our first flash take on it. And then there's its parts. So it has legs. Let's just call it legs, a seat, and a back. We could break it in, and also like screws, and nails, and glue, and varnish, and stuff. So those are all the parts. And you can see how when you put all those parts together in a certain combination like that, then at some point you put enough parts together, and at some point we start calling it a chair. And we can start deconstructing it too. Like if we take the back off, well, it's a chair. It's more like a stool, but we still call it a chair. If you took the seat off and you just had the legs with the frame, then we might say like a frame of a chair. I think it was a chair. If you took the legs off and you just had like the frame, and you could even have the same pieces, in fact. You wouldn't have to get rid of anything, but you would just spread them out on the floor. And at some point, it would not be a chair, right? So we don't actually say the chair is just the combination of its parts. Now can you see how this is very applicable to like the self and its parts being the five skandhas. And we don't actually say that the self is just the combination of body, mind, five skandhas, but we say that this subtle difference between a kind of gross view of selflessness and a subtle view of selflessness, which I brought up before, but this is a subtle point. So I'll say again that we don't say that the self is just the combination of five skandhas. We might sometimes hear it like that, and it's a simple way to talk about it, but that's what like the Dalai Lama says. If you hear it like that and understand it like that, that's not enough to cut through our delusion. It's the subtlety is that the self is a conceptual imputation dependent on the body-mind experience. It's not the same as the body-mind experience. It's making it clear that it's just a mere conceptual imputation dependent on body-mind. In this types of selfless, remember number two, the conceptually imputed self. It's just a mere concept. So here we could say, to talk more accurately, what is the chair? What is the mere chair? You know, how would a Buddha talk about this chair, right? Like, how would a Buddha see this chair? The mere chair is just a conceptual imputation called chair, dependent on its parts. Dependent on the legs, the seat, and the back. You can see the difference between it's just a collection of legs and seat and back. It's not quite the same as saying that. It's bringing in this idea of like the mind is creating something when you have a certain combination. Because if you just say a certain combination, it suddenly becomes a chair, an actual chair. That's like magic, right? It couldn't like become like an existent chair just by like collecting parts. But if you collect the parts at some point, we create this idea of a chair. It's just a mere concept of a chair. But when you see it, isn't it just like the difference between 2 and 3 here? The leap from the conceptual imputation to an inherently existing one. When we see it, we don't say, oh, that's just my mind. It's like creating an image dependent on these parts. We see it as a chair. I mean, don't we? I mean, through this, if you really get familiar with Nagarjuna, it might be that you're really thinking about these things, contemplating it, things start to break down what they seem, or we still project, and we shouldn't stop projecting, but we start to see everything as just this projection of like essence onto just this flux of like stuff, because actually the parts themselves are all exactly the same too. A chair leg is also made up of parts, and it's also just a conception called chair leg, dependent on a piece of wood that's kind of long and narrow with varnish on it and a screw hole to screw into the top, or however we define it. And the very fact that we maybe define it a little differently starts to prove also that it's not some inherently existent chair leg, like. And obviously, people in like African rainforest who just never seen anything like this, it's not a chair leg for them. Is it a piece of wood for them? Yeah, we might agree it's a piece of wood, but that's also just a conceptual imputation dependent on hardness and looking like grain in it and stuff. And you can break that down even more, like what are like molecules of, what are wood molecules? What are electrons? And like you can't, in the end, you can't find anything at all. That's the, But.
So the first kind was it is the skandhas, it is the assembly of the parts. The second thing is it is dependent upon the parts.
Yeah.
And there's a third one too. Isn't there that says how the thing is used? So if that were a teapot and it's got plants growing out of it, is it a teapot?
Yeah,
I would say. The first two still apply.
Yeah, I think that, so it kind of goes with the first one in that it's dependent on its use. It's a kind of dependency, right? A teapot is to call it a teapot, it depends on being used for tea. And to call this a chair, it's not just physical stuff. It also has to do with its use. You're right. That's part of its dependence. In order to make that conceptual imputation of a chair, it is like its use, right? So, for like this, and I'm using it like this, it's a table or a lectern or something. And I stop relating it to as a chair, and I don't really would stop thinking of it as a chair temporarily, if things are also dependent on their use, but their use, so that's all tied into conceptual imputation too, right? Like you might use it for something else and call it something.
So when we say
a ladder, for changing light bulbs.
So when people say, "Who are you?" and I say, "I'm a fireman."
Mm-hmm.
That says something of my identity as a useful object. It's a third kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I may be a fireman, but I'm also this combination of body and mind that's dependent on this guy. And I am this particular collection of this.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. When we think of, that's one that Nagarjuna, I don't think, brings up so much in terms of the self or the person, but it's a good addition there that we're also our identity as a person. Often has to do with our role or occupation. I have seen it in later commentaries. Actually, they say, and often that's what we identify with most. Like, I'm body and mind, but actually, like, right now, I'm really, like the teacher here. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not even so in my body. I'm just, like, doing this role, and that's who I really am. So, But again, the same principle of it's just a depend... It's just it's an idea dependent on various things. Like, because I usually come and like start talking, that's what I mean by like teaching the class or something. But it's all just those are all just conceptual imputations. That's why there's the Zen koan. Don't you know in all of China there's no teachers of Zen? And then the monk says, well, what about all those people in the Zen temples, like, you know, saying Dharma stuff and practicing meditation and stuff? And he says, I don't say there's no Zen, there's just no teachers of Zen. But, you know, we could take it further and say, actually, there's no Zen either. There's really no Zen. Of course. So, maybe we can come back to these physical examples when we get into, like, the body-mind thing, because they're very straightforward. And you really can see how if you start to take the pieces apart, at some point, which is going to be different for everybody, it's going to cease to be a chair. And same with five skandhas. You can start eliminating skandhas, and at some point you're going to stop calling it a person or a self, like a dead person. The form skandha, well, I guess technically the form skandha is the active sense organs. But there's definitely a material thing there, but the other four are all turned off. And we still kind of project the self sometimes if you go into like an open casket funeral, is arranged for the very reason that we still project the self onto one skanda.
So
yeah. I just want to see him one more time. He's not there, actually, right?
Looks so young.
Yeah, it's interesting. We, you know, and then, but if you watch the decay, and that's why it's a traditional practice, you can...
That would be a lively funeral.
Yeah. When I was in Thailand, I was at this Thai monastery, and we took this field trip to visit another monastery. This was like a monk's field trip, like, you know, a picnic day, going to visit this other temple where they had this corpse, a human corpse, that was like as a kind of meditation experiment. They had set up in this glass case so that it wouldn't smell, with an air tube going out, and in sawdust, you know, nicely arranged. And they're just going to like watch it go from a human person into like dust, which maybe would take a lot of, like, maybe, well, I don't know how long it took. That was the experiment. But no worms or anything, just sawdust. But bacteria, air is going to do it, and probably less than a year. I don't know. But just like to watch that breakdown of what we think is a person. And
when does it stop becoming?
And I think those Buddha had those meditations that maybe sound really gruesome, but like it really, we tend to start applying them to ourselves and like, what is this that I think is so really here? And when we know we're going to die, but like the vividness of seeing that kind of thing is like, I don't even know what's happening anymore or who I am as a person. Yeah.
In this disarming experience, Friday morning, I cut a head of lettuce and I found a dead worm in it. And I didn't cut it with a knife, it was already dead. It was decomposing. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of disarmed by not realizing that, like, I think it was like a big worm, like a nightcrawler or something. Mm-hmm. And then, like, kind of overpowered by the smell of decay that kind of became available when the lettuce was close to my face. But it was like grappling, like, literally I was just like my perception or some, a lot of different things were like cut off in my usual way of functioning. Mm. And I kind of, like, said to the group as I'm doing the demonstration, like, gosh, I didn't realize the worms had the red blood, and how did it die? And the smell was so strong. So it was really interesting how it just, like, stops the normal normal function of mind. Surprise of the situation.
Yeah. I mean, yesterday was, maybe just Mila was here, we did this animal release ceremony, liberating life ceremony for crickets. And it was also kind of strange because it's like an ordination ceremony. So we're doing this whole kind of thing with these crickets on the table and, you know, giving them refuges and very kind of elaborate thing. And they're just kind of chirping here. And like these living beings, they're really this sense of like they're in boxes where you buy them in these plastic boxes, say crickets. And they're kind of dying in the boxes and stuff. And that kind of contrast, too, of, like, this is a weird way to be doing this kind of ceremony. Or something was strange about it, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Like the contrast.
Oh yeah, you were here for that too. Well, it didn't seem so strange in a way, and yet it just brought up the fact that there are the sense of them as living beings, as sentient beings, became very strong to me. And more, you know, I don't.
Were they wearing moccasins?
Little ones, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it.
Can I have a coffee?
Yes. So we're on this reasons that inherently exist in self cannot exist page. And now we'll just limit it to what seems like, to start with, these two possibilities of the I, in quotes, the self being identical to or the same.
What's at the very top of your page?
Reasons that inherently exist in self cannot exist. You need another one? You want another?
You know better?
And that first top paragraph was all about just saying in various ways about if it were to be inherently existent, it would have to be either the same as body and mind or five skandhas. Same, you know, these are synonyms. Or completely separate, different, unrelated to body and mind. So now, step number one here, or like this is, you know, the closet number one we're going to look in, where the self might exist.
Okay.
If it were to exist, if it were to be identical, if we could find that it's identical, then we've got it. That's it. We have an inherently existent self, and we can stop, and we just suffer. But so that's the thing is here, we're going to say, if it were the same as, these are going to be some problems. Because we need to find the reasons why it can't fit into number one. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to disprove now that the inherently existent self cannot be the same as body and mind, meaning completely identical to. And now remember, what we're talking about is an inherently, independently existent self. So these are like four different reasons, kind of different reasons why it's not going to work. If it were the same, it would have to arise and cease, just as the body and mind do, moment to moment. So it's kind of it's taking up impermanence, because remember, one of the qualities of inherent existence is it is permanent. It's more than just permanence, but that is one of the qualities of it. That's the first sentence at the very top of the page. Inherently existent I is defined as permanent, singular, and independent. So in this case, we know that body and mind are impermanent. So this is going to be pretty easy, right? Body and mind, every aspect of the five skandhas in a moment-to-moment way is arising and ceasing. And what we're talking about is something that doesn't do that. So it would have to arise and cease, just as body and mind do moment-to-moment. For example, just as feelings change every instant, that's one skandha, so the self would last only one instant and then be replaced by another. An inherently existent self is permanent, and body and mind are impermanent. Then also, there would be no memory of past selves, since each self would be unrelatedly different from one another. You see, like, the self would not depend on a previous self. The self exists in and of itself in this moment, independent of body-mind experience. So if we say it is just the body-mind experience right now, even in an impermanent way, now this is where it could get more, go beyond even permanent, just this momentary body-mind experience is an independent self, but it can't refer to like yesterday's. If it was, you know, related somehow, even being able to remember yesterday's body-mind experience, then it's dependent on a previous one. It doesn't exist in and of itself. See that?
Why couldn't memory just be an instantaneous present reality too?
Well, it is actually, right?
Yeah. Without reference, it's just what's there in the mind.
But it actually does reference yesterday, right? Yesterday's personal experience.
we impute that. Yeah.
Yeah, you could say, well, maybe that's completely a dream. We didn't have yesterday. We were born right now, and our whole memory of our past life. Mm-hmm. There's probably science fiction movies, which is completely just a made up dream. Mm-hmm. I think as a kid, sometimes I would think that way. Like, I wonder if like all my life up to this point was like implanted in my brain by like some scientists just to make me think that, and they're all playing a trick on me, and none of it really happened. I used to think like that. Kids think this. Kids are really open to this, like Nagarjunian kind of thought, just because they're like they're not so fixed into like a certain way. Like, what if that was the case? Yeah.
I just have to throw in my doubts about
that. Oh, yeah, please. This is what we should do.
I want to refute.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So, just going to the very first sentence, for example, or second sentence. For example, just mm-hmm. as feelings change every instant. Mm-hmm. So I had problems with that because I don't necessarily think feelings change every instant. I think change means one to another. And so I would use grows.
Grows?
Yes. And so if I use that, mm-hmm. it's not... this, and then this, and then this, and then this. But somehow I believe the feelings grow and the self grows.
Ah.
So it's not a separate moment to moment, though I'm sure that's very interesting.
But we can look at what is growth and change, actually. And I think Nagarjuna has a whole chapter on change, maybe, in a way. So if we examine what growth actually is, isn't it also... An example of impermanence. Maybe we don't say change, because actually I agree that change isn't such a good word. I think technically speaking, in Buddhism, we don't say that things change. This is an interesting point, I think, because we say Buddhism is just the basic teaching, everything changes. Well, technically, that's kind of sounds like maybe what you're saying is that there's something that's kind of evolving and morphing and changing into something else. But technically, things don't change into something else. They just cease. Actually, that things just arise in one moment, and they last. And there's, in Abhidharma, they talk about like how many fractions of a second things last for. It's kind of ridiculous, because it's like no time, really. And then they actually just cease. And then that cessation, this came up when we were talking about rebirth too, right? There's a cessation of consciousness and feeling, and all five skandhas cease. And then that cessation is a condition for the arising of a new feeling. For one moment, boom! I mean, this is just, we might not feel like our experience, but this would be like a technical way of talking about what impermanence means. Is that things don't last, nothing physical or mental lasts for more than one instant. But it seems to change or transform or grow.
I have a visual grow. Thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's say I have a bucket of water.
Yeah.
And I'm pouring water into it.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So even with one drop,
uh-huh.
I've changed the whole meaning of this total thing. So the one drop's not separate.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the whole meaning has changed. So that's how I'm meaning growing. So
yeah, this is an interesting point.
So that's how my mind's working. So that I don't really... So it is kind of the one and the same, but sort of separate. Same with the universe thing I was bringing up a couple weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
It's another medium, but it's the same.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think also of chapter one of Nagarjuna, and I think maybe you came at the beginning of that one, but... one example that's used all through chapter one, which is about dependent co-arising, is the seed and the sprout example,
mm-hmm.
is the example that gets used just to show that a seed doesn't change into a sprout. And a seed actually, a sprout doesn't come from a seed. And it's not that a seed changes into a sprout, but that the sprout is dependent on a seed. So they do look at, Nagarjuna looks at like what is change and motion. He's got a whole chapter on what is motion. You can deconstruct it. There's no such thing as movement. I think it's the second chapter actually in the book. We can't find what we call movement, which is similar, I think, to change or growth, like a growth from a baby into an adult. It's not really that the baby changed. That's what a view of a self would be. It's like there's some actual baby that's the self of the baby just grows into an adult. And that's what we're seeing is there's a dependent relationship. And when you mentioned the water in the bucket, I thought, adding that one drop does make a completely different situation. But even without adding the drop, you have a bucket of water that's totally still here. And now the next second, it's actually a completely different bucket of water without even adding a drop.
Yeah.
You know, because that's what impermanence means. It's like that whole bucket ceased. and another one arose, and we could say, well, it looks so similar, but that's because it's not random. It's not like a bucket of lizards or something arises instead. It's like there's like laws to dependent co-arising that the conditionality is such that like the previous condition is very, very similar to the following condition or the following effect, so that it's virtually the same. And it looks exactly the same. And if we add a drop, it's in a way the same idea. You can add a drop or not add a drop, but it's still a completely different bucket, dependent on the previous bucket. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and you could say, realizing that it's kind of dependent on my knowledge of the drop too. Like I really, this is actually a good example of you saying no drop
at
all for me. But it's completely new.
Yeah, it depends on our knowledge. So in a way, it's a whole other projection about permanence in things. Even like, we know things are, basically impermanent. Like, we're going to die. They talk about it as like gross impermanence, that like a human lifespan is always so long. But like subtle impermanence is like every moment we're a completely new person. And that's also like the chair. It's not the same chair as even like a split second ago.
It's not even in the same location because the earth is spinning.
You could be add that in. Yeah.
So there's all these things we're so unaware of.
Even that.
I believe it's the same.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. So in the example you mentioned it as is feelings change every instant, and you say they so that applies here, that they actually don't really change every instant. I shouldn't even really write that it changes. Feelings arise and cease every instant. That's how, more correctly, you could say the first sentence. It would have to arise and cease just as body and mind do. Every moment to moment, body and mind arise and cease. But we're talking about a self that doesn't do that. And we might say, that might be an argument. Often it was interesting that you brought up feelings, because I think we often think, well, those four skandhas, feelings, perceptions, conceptions, karmic formations, and although consciousness is a little tricky, but that those tend to be our mental experience is changing every moment, but the body, we feel like, well, we're just sitting really still, but that's not changing. But of course it is. And even scientists talk about how the molecules are all changing. But consciousness is an interesting one too, because I think that's the hardest one actually to see how it changes. Because it seems like, well, there's this awareness of what's happening. That's what doesn't change. And and yet, actually, it does. In terms of, if we're talking about the fifth skandha of consciousness, it's a dualistic, maybe quite subtly dualistic consciousness that's dependent on objects. And it arises and ceases and arises in slightly different ways dependent on different mental objects. Yes?
I'm just wondering if that things arising and ceasing every minute, if that or a second, now does that have to do with, the molecular thing or, molecules change? Or are you talking about something more than that?
Yeah, I'd say more than that. But that is a nice modern scientific thing about the molecules changing, because I think I've heard some fact like every 7 years all our cells in our body are completely different. It's a 7-year cycle.
Yeah,
so like
carbon thing.
Yeah, so, you know, they're all changing all the time, but after 7 years, none are the same as 7 years previously. They're completely renewed. We have a completely different physical body. I think that's totally cool. But this is like actually even more radical in a way. It's a saying, and it's a view. We might not be able to see this actually, but this would be like the view of Buddha Dharma is that no thing, phenomena, mental or physical, lasts more than one tiny moment. Not just physical and not just cells, but in other words, it's not, maybe we should say, the way they would be different is that the rate with which a cell decays is, I don't know what that is, but scientists probably know that how quickly a cell, how the lifespan of a cell, say, but we're talking about, this is probably shorter than that. The impermanence we're talking about is...
But is it physical impermanence? Are you talking about something that's physical? Because I've been hearing physical over and over, but I'm thinking that there's more than that.
Well, it's kind of like, what is physical? When we start really looking, it's like, for now, let's just say, yeah, including physical. I mean, we might be getting into, especially if we're talking from the point of view of mind-only school, it's like there's actually not really such thing as physicality at all. It's all mental projection. But just say for now, because not all schools agree with that, that physical things, like a rock, is actually completely ceases each moment, and a new rock, you know, arises dependent on that rock. That's at least the way I understand it.
Certainly every time I think of the rock, while the word is the same, the rock is different. So I can say pen, mm-hmm. I can find this pen any place. Mm-hmm. And for me, the word pen is the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which gives, and because I picked this thing up,
yeah.
But there are subtle changes going on here all the time.
Yeah.
Somebody else may have used it as a pry tool in the meantime.
Mm.
But for
it
me,
stopped
it's
being a pen when it was
so
a pry tool.
So because I always call this a pen, it has the illusion of being permanently a pen. But in actuality, it only arises every time I look at it and say pen.
That's also a good, that's bringing back into this whole Madhyamaka thing and like, the chair, it depends on its use, and the pen, you go into use also. And it also reminds me of the talk about, there's generic images, or there's specific characteristics and general characteristics. This is kind of like even pre-Madhyamaka, kind of Abhidharma stuff. Is that and specific characteristics of the pen are like that more like the actual building blocks of that are of the pen or something like that, and they're completely impermanent. Specific characteristics are the when we break something down into its smallest dharmas, those are impermanent. But the general characteristics or the general characteristics of the pen are like a kind of abstract image of a pen, and that's actually permanent. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, they say generic characteristics of things. This term, samanya lakshana, it's like a general image of something. And interestingly, and it's permanent. It's defined as permanent because, you know, maybe it doesn't. Oh, if you die or something, and maybe it doesn't last, but. But when I first heard that, I thought, that's weird. You'd think that the specific things that are really what things are would be like more real and permanent, and the generic thing would just come and go. But it's the opposite. And can you understand why it relates to our conversation? That the specific characteristics are the actual phenomena that, if we're talking about physical things, this is in early Buddhism before they got into everything's empty, just the atoms that make things up or whatever. The specific phenomena that we can only see also in direct perception, though that's what's impermanent. Well, if we're experiencing something in direct perception, we're experiencing this kind of radical impermanence. brought in indirect perception or conceptual thought. We're just perceiving generic images like pans and chairs, and those are permanent. Really weird, but isn't that so? Like, that's the way it seems. Like, this chair is the same chair as we were talking about a half an hour ago. That's kind of permanent, but the actual specific characteristics of the chair are constantly arising in CC. In a way, the generic image is kind of like the inherent existence, or it's related to that. It's a different system.
Can I refer to Yogacara for a second?
Okay.
Okay, because I think we're very close on this. The mm-hmm. seventh consciousness, mm-hmm. which is kind of the imputation engine.
Yeah, imputation engine.
It actually imputes itself. It says, yeah. This is my mind.
Yeah. It's, I think in some ways we could say, if we're from the point of view of Yogacara mind-only school, what is the, how does this number two self, the conceptually imputed self, like what is that, or how does that one work? I think we could say it's the seventh consciousness called Manas, which is, it's like, Tenzin Roshi has that image of like, there's the storehouse consciousness is like this ocean of like all our past experience, right? It's like, and it's inconceivable, and it's just this churning mass of like life, right? But we can't go in there and look around in there. It sprouts stuff. It sprouts, there's seeds planted in it, right? It's just a storehouse of seeds of experience, and they sprout experiences that we're then conscious of. But the seventh consciousness, his image is like, it's like this ocean, and like a mirror on a pole like rises out of the ocean and like reflects back on itself, and like it kind of like, it's like self-consciousness. It like, it's like just part of the storehouse. It's not really that special, but it rises up and thinks it's like the ultimately special thing. It's like me. Now it's like, we have like, now there's me that actually, I think that this ocean is me now, basically. Even though I can't see everything in it, I have this feeling that the ocean is me. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the Yogacara school, they say that the mere I is actually alaya vijnana, the storehouse consciousness. But we could say it's that sense of creating that as the I is involves the seventh consciousness kind of reflecting back on it.
So this reminds us, this here reminds mm-hmm. us, that the seventh consciousness is in fact the construction. It is an imputation engine.
It's all construction.
Yeah.
But it's the constructor, you could say too. Yeah. Yeah, the constructor. Yeah, I mean, it takes a lot to construct our world, actually. I think that's one of the big ones. But it also, all five skandhas we need to construct this experience. Yeah. We need all five. And that's part of the fifth skandha. It's part of consciousness skandha, technically, in that system. But conception, if we just take the early model before mind-only school, five skandhas model, the third skandha of conception, in a way, plays that role.
Yeah.
It's like it's the conceptualizing factor that takes a direct experience of sensory data or a feeling, the first two skandhas, and it kind of knows them. It labels them and knows them.
Labels.
Yeah.
I just want to say I have a little bit of frustration because mm-hmm. I felt like I was with you and you were kind of
giving
me this big preamble and we were finally going to get here. And now, this is interesting, but I feel like...
let's keep going.
Well, I'm not sure how what this... Now I feel lost, and I'm starting to feel grounded. And not that me being grounded is any big goal or anything, but I'm really lost. It's like,
I think this is all related, but it's a divergent sidetrack, too.
It gets too, like... It makes me want to get really firm and say, there is a rock. It does exist, you know, and I don't really want to have to go there. But this kind of like micro analysis that my being starts wanting to react to it and be, you know.
Let's not look at this kind of thing of things changing moment to moment. Even though it's interesting, I think that's not the main way that Nagarjuna is going to go about
like,
this.
I don't know yet what the Nagarjuna teaching is. I don't understand this yet.
Mm-hmm. So, well, let's keep going because they're going to have different ways. Remember, this first one, we got into all this, I think, because this first one is really about impermanence. It's talking about the arising and ceasing of body and mind. But the next one is going to be have a completely different
but
proof
I haven't
here.
Even gotten the first one.
So do you get if the I, the self, were the same as body and mind, it would have to arise and cease just like the body and mind do.
And by definition, the I, if it's an inherent I, is permanent.
Yes.
So just
it couldn't arise and cease.
Reading that line and then reading the definition of I in the very first line of the page, it already refutes. It's already refuted.
Mm-hmm.
You read one definition at the top of the page.
That it's permanent. That an inherently existent I is permanent, particular. Yeah. If it were permanent, how could it be the same as body and mind? Because body and mind are not permanent. How about that?
Well, okay, so let me try it backwards. Body and mind are not permanent.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore,
if the self was the same as body and mind,
it would be impermanent.
And that's not.
And that's refuting then that it is permanent.
Yeah.
Because
you could say it in all these different ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what we're talking about, what we're refuting in the first place, is a permanent, singular, independent self. So, if it were permanent and singular, and it were the same as body and mind, we have a problem.
Okay, so the first checkoff is, okay, so it's not the same as body and mind.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, if you can really come to that conclusion, and you can spend some more time with this, you know, at home. Too. And really, I think all these things, we're probably not going to get totally familiar with it just by going through them. But if you get a sense of what the words mean, remember these three kinds of wisdom, right? You get the words down, and then you can reflect on these kind of arguments over and over. And for me, just to, as a little plug for this, I find some of them, when I first read them, I'm like, this is so weird, and like, why bother with this argument or something? Or it's so abstract sounding that it doesn't move me at all. And then like, over time, and sometimes it's actually years, or I'll come pick it up the next year and be like, oh wow, I totally see why he, you know, that's so, and it's so clear and so directly experiential. It's not abstract at all. Sometimes it's like that, but I think it's like you really have to spend time with it. And it's a weird way of thinking. I'll definitely admit that this is not how we, this is logic. And we're not logical people. We're logical in some ways, but our logic is very flawed. Because, for example, we think that's a chair. That's flawed logic. I mean, we think it's really a chair.
It's kind of great to have it first, though, because I think there's billions of people running around the planet who just think they're themselves, you know.
Well, everyone, basically.
Yeah. So we all think exist.
Yeah, this is really, really unusual thing to start to see how we're not who we think we are. Or, you know, the Dalai Lama's book, is the title is How to See Yourself as You Really Are. It's like, how many people are ever going to see themselves as they really are? Like,
I guess
very
what
few.
I struggle with is that, like, I basically, on faith, I accept the punchline.
No, don't go with faith. Don't go with faith.
You know, I accept the punchline, but I'm, like, trying to be a good sport.
Yes,
like, okay,
you have to.
Okay, so you're telling me this logic is really important.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, then help me get the logic.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, mm-hmm. I'm going to just be taking it on faith.
Yeah, yeah. No, in this case,
and I'm still
that's like the monster under the bed, right?
Yeah.
You'll still be, like, slightly disturbed that there might be one. Until we're totally convinced, right? So, do you get so one more time, right, with this first one.
So the first one.
So if we're talking about a permanent independence I, right?
Mm-hmm.
If that were the same as the impermanent body and mind,
mm-hmm.
already, how could something
could be
permanent
okay,
be the same
so
as something
that
impermanent?
One that one's out.
Right.
Okay.
X.
Impermanent body and mind, not the.
You could even tear it right out the paper.
It's like that, right? You do that, right? Not same as.
Yeah, not same
okay.
as.
Okay.
Got
next.
It? In a way, that's the one that you'll actually see in Nagarjuna's verse 1. He uses that first argument.
It's like, damn it, I'm supposed to get the logic. I at least need to be able to say I checked off a few boxes.
Check it off.
Okay, I checked off.
check that
one. Next. Now we're gonna like move on from impermanence.
Oh, no.
And we're gonna look at singularity. Remember, it's the I is defined as permanent, singular, and independent in this first sentence at the top of the page.
Okay.
It's a this chair is not like multiple chairs, right? When we see it, doesn't it seem like it's just one chair and me? Now we might say, well, I'm different. Sometimes I'm a fireman and sometimes I'm a Zen student. But actually, that's not what we're talking. That's not the independent self we're looking for. That's a kind of conventional, flexible kind of self. We're looking for, like, I feel like there's somebody who's the same when I'm a fireman and a Zen student, right? So, and there's just one of them. That's why it's singular. There's a one of the true me. This is how we really feel. Don't we feel?
There's a core that exists.
Yeah.
Whatever we do.
Whatever we do. We feel like there's one self.
Okay, so now we're on that.
Works differently.
That's part of our experience.
That works a lot until you go home to see your family for a holiday. And then you realize, oh, I'm not who I thought I was.
Well, we have this conventional, self that does change and stuff, but we're talking about the core identity. And this is looking at singularity now.
Where are we now?
This is the second paragraph in number one.
Okay.
So now we're going to say, now again, all of these are the predicate of the sentence in bold. So right, if the I is identical to the aggregates of body and mind, mm-hmm. it would have to be many in number, just as the aggregates of body and mind are many.
Right.
Body, whether you say it's five skandhas, that's five. Whether you say body and mind, that's two. But whether you say it's like 75 dharmas, it's not a singular experience, right? Our body-mind experience has a multiplicity to it, but the self is one. This is a particular argument that I find actually quite difficult. Conceptually, it works, but to get an experiential feeling for it is harder.
How about a movie? You have the movie. Mm-hmm. The movie exists, it is the movie. But in reality, it's hundreds of thousands of individual pictures.
Yeah. Yep, that's a good one. Mm-hmm. That it's multiple things, but
so
it seems like one thing.
There's many in number, like all the frames of a movie.
That's also kind of related to the first one about changing.
But it's not that, it's pretending that it's singular. Reputation is because it's not singular. It's not the same as multiple.
Yeah, body and mind are multiple.
Yeah.
And we're trying to refute a singular self. So if it were identical, now if it were the same, if the self, if we go on to these other categories of non-identical, we might say, well, there is one singular self, but it's not body and mind. It's something independent of it.
It's not the aggregates.
It's not the aggregates,
but
right?
But right now, that's what we're working on.
If it's the same as,
So it's not the same as the multiple.
It's not the same as the multiple. Does that
aggregates.
People get that?
Well,
at least theoretically.
The same as the multiple, but one part's really dominant. The little somewhere in there that says, that's me. That part is not interested in really what a fingernail feels or hair on the leg feels.
So if we kind of single out maybe even one skanda, say, or a body part or something, like the heart, or still, I think you can break anything we can find, we can break into parts. Like, do you have an example of some part of yourself
I'm trying to look at what's the little machine?
The brain.
This notion of me.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
I guess it's not really an
skull.
Well, we might think that. That might be a modern view, is that the self-identity is actually the brain. That might be a psychobiological modern view, right? But the brain is not a singular thing, right? It has the cerebral cortex and the right and left side. And we might say, well, there's one little part of the brain, right? They can map out. And I think they actually do have an identity, right, in some part of the brain. They found a sense of a self in the brain, I think. So even that, it's not a pinpoint. I don't think it's a pinpoint. So if you, and as soon as you have parts, you don't have inherent existence anymore. And in fact, excuse me if this is a little divergence, but I can't help doing this because I never think of saying this again. That's how they talk about the emptiness of physical atoms. We might say when we break down things into like everything, there's no chairs and stuff, there's just atoms. This is a kind of scientific view too, right? But or an electron, let's get this even smaller than an atom. Electron, you can't break it down, it's singular. And in fact, 500 BC, they had this, the Buddhists had these stories of like atoms. They had these building blocks, these minute building blocks that were the real thing. And then they actually said, those are like ultimate truth, these building blocks, the early Buddhist schools before Nagarjuna. And now Nagarjuna comes along and says, you can't, they're just as empty. And the reason you can't, maybe none of these other arguments would work, but the one that they usually use is about singularity. It's like, there's no such thing as a partless particle. Because, say, if you magnify an electron to this big, just to like get a look at it, it doesn't have different substances, it's one solid type of substance, but it still has a top and a bottom. And there you have parts, and so you don't have, as soon as you have parts, it's not like a singular essence. That might sound weird and abstract, but if you really contemplate...
Well, that's like the
Jacobian numbers. Yeah, exactly. It's the same argument as... And much harder to kind of really...
The self is in the top quadrant.
Yeah. The point is, there's no such thing as a partless particle. No matter how... Well, you take the top part, well, it still has parts. There's no such thing, actually, as a partless particle. And that's an argument for emptiness of particles. Like, there can't be, like, a singular, you know, substance of something. It's all, can be broken down. Yeah. So anyway, that's a kind of a weird little sidetrack, but it's the same, it's much easier to do when we're talking about bigger things, like even a part of the brain, which is really, these examples are really great, by the way, because I think we should look at it from our modern point of view and make sure that it holds up.
What about Karen Quinlan?
I think we're traveling away here.
I mean, was Karen Quinlan there vegetative, a person? And when people said she never would have liked to be in this condition, therefore we should pull the plug on her, you know, what is this sense of self? And her sense of self right there in that bed at that time.
Mm-hmm. I think there's
any moral judgment about that.
Yeah, or even someone in a coma or something, it's like, is there a sense of self? I mean, I think let's try to get through this, but I think these things are, we could look at them, but they're like, they're a little, I think let's examine them on our own in order to get through this. But I think, does a person in a coma have a sense of a self? But for purposes of our suffering, I think it's not totally the most important thing right now.
Really?
Whether a person in a coma has a self?
No. It's the idea of the migrating sense of self that goes through. I think it's very germane. Is there one sense of self? Is there one I that goes through all these changes that is itself independent? I think that's a valid question.
But isn't the whole thing here that the premise is that isn't true.
It's equally invalid for a person in a coma, for a person conscious.
That's the premise, as I understand, that this thing is trying to.
I think it's more tangible to get through with my mind than the features of an atom. It's a real person, and I've been in a state that I can say that from now until next week, say, if I get hit by a car, what is the self? Mm-hmm. Under these circumstances, such that I can say that I had a self yesterday of a certain kind.
Well, the conventional self. Yeah, there is no independent self, just like there never is. But and you could say, what the interesting question is, what's the conventionally imputed self for that person? And they're kind of temporarily maybe not imputing one. They're like their imputing thing is shut down, but their inherently existent self, which is the one we're really concerned with here, is equally never was the case and never will be. But their number two, the conceptually imputed self, someone, even when you're asleep, the conceptually imputed self, unless you're dreaming, like in a deep sleep, I think we're not conceptually imputing a self. And, but equally in all people and objects and everything, there's no inherently existent self. Let's just go through the, since it's almost time to stop, these last little bits here. So again, number two, the second paragraph here was, it would have to be many in number, just as aggregates of body and mind are many. Each part of the body would be a different self, and each thought would be a different self. Right? These are like the different parts. That's kind of the reverse thing. There would have to be multiple selves. Right? So this is a kind of absurd way of talking about it. Like, there's the self of my hand, and the self of my head, and the self of my feeling. And it's just kind of an absurd way of talking about it. There would be no sense of oneself as an individual, single person. So that's a kind of experiential statement about it, actually.
So in other words...
we have this sense that we're like one person.
So if it were true that this singular, independent self were many in number, then that would mean that each part of the body is a different self. And because that's not true, therefore, mm-hmm. that one doesn't hold.
Yeah, body and mind.
Body and mind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think that's the experiential part, is we have this sense that we're just one person. We're not like, well, myself is kind of like multiple selves. I mean, there's split personality people. But even then, that might be the closest thing to like feeling like we have multiple identities. But generally, we feel like even if we have different roles at different times, there's somebody who's the same all throughout. So number three is, it would no longer be able... So again, if the eye is identical to body and mind, it would no longer be able to possess body and mind. This is, I think, a good one that's commonly we feel. This is about, there's a self that it seems like my body, right? My body and my mind. One no longer could say my head, my feelings, or my thoughts, since those statements assume that the self and body and mind are different. This is kind of saying, if body and mind were the same as exactly identical, it wouldn't make sense to ever say, like, my body, right? Because how could, like, the self that is the body...
It would be outside.
It would be outside, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, this possession thing is going to come up again in number five down at the bottom, if the eye possesses the body and mind.
So... if I'm referring to my body, mm-hmm. it's saying it's separate from her body.
Yeah.
It's not saying, doing it, I would just say body, body, body.
But you don't.
And because I'm in a room full of other bodies,
uh-huh.
I have to clarify, well, I'm talking about this one.
But don't you think that it's more than that experientially?
Maybe.
Doesn't it feel like it's really, there's some you whose body it is? Especially, like you could say when you're, if somebody is about to like chop off your hand or something, like, that's my body. Or, you know,
it's
my hand, yeah. It's my hand. Or like, even, you know, you're just alone in a room, but like, my stomach hurts. You're not, it's not just a convenient thing we're comparing to somebody else.
Yeah.
We often feel as if...
She reluctantly...
No, I'm just sort of like... I'm noticing that the my is in a location in my body. And if I were to say my foot, it's because my foot is further away from where I view the center of where me is.
You think it's where?
The center of you.
Brain?
Well, it's interesting because when you were saying brain, I wasn't feeling like I was brain, and I was getting to something about the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really know where to go with that. It was almost like you know, if you turn a projector on and you're watching a movie, you know, and then ooh, it goes off, and you're like, huh, it's turned off. There's, there's like a spirit that's contingent on the brain, so it's not the brain. I don't think.
Yeah.
The me that I think is here is the brain. But
spirit contingent. Yeah. It's often connected in the head area, I think, although because our sense organs are gathered up here, and that's how we relate to the world, so it's like our control station is up here. But one of these Madhyamaka texts said, I don't know if this is true, because they were talking about Vedanta, and often when they quote these other schools, they don't really, they have a distorted view, but they said there's some schools of Vedanta that say that the self, when they believe in an independent core Atman self, and they say it actually resides physically in the heart chakra. The self has a physical location in the heart, and so sometimes different cultures they do point, I'm here, and we might sometimes feel at different times too like that's our core identity. If we had to pick a location, sometimes maybe if we're thinking a lot, it's up here. If we're feeling kind of more emotional, it's here. If a knife lands on your toe, then you feel like yourself's right here sometimes. Like, this is me. That's
When your toe hurts or some body part hurts, your full identity.
Yeah, our identity. Yeah.
There.
So it moves around the body, which is partly gives us a clue that it's not something, because it's like, you could say how that actually works is like our mental conceptual imputation is constantly just shifting it around at its convenience. And we can say, like I brought up at the beginning, you could say, sometimes we say my body, which is like the view that the self is separate from the body of mine, and sometimes we say, this is me, and that's like, seems like it's the same. They're kind of contradictory views, but our language says this. But this is just referring to this kind of conventional thing of like, we could no longer say that in an accurate way. If body and mind were identical to this independent self, we could no longer say, quote, my head, my feelings, my thoughts.
Check. Let's accept that.
You can think about these. Just the last one, just to get through this one. If the I were identical to body and mind, it would meet with the results of actions not done by itself, or a self which was totally different from the self that committed the action would undergo the results of that action. So this is like, we might say, like, I didn't commit that crime. That was a different body and mind, right? And sometimes, in a way, that's maybe closer to the truth in a little bit than, like, there's this core me that did do it. Because it wasn't really the I, but this is saying there's no connection at all. It's saying this body and mind today is a completely different body. There's no connection at all to the body and mind that committed the crime yesterday. We can't say that. What we can actually most accurately say is it's not actually the same self as yesterday, because there isn't one. But this body and mind depends on those ones, and that's how karma can work, and can work without a self. Just like this, because it's dependent, you know? This body and mind is dependent on yesterday's body and mind. There's no independent core thing traveling through or growing or changing from yesterday to today, technically. But it's a middle way. It's not that there's some continuous self, and it's not that we're totally unrelated at all. This would be kind of saying that, you know, it would have to fall into that extreme of like the results of the actions coming now are like a completely different person than yesterday, if the I was identical to the body and mind, which changes. It's kind of related to the first one. It's kind of a little problematic consequence of the first argument about the rising and ceasing. It's related. So we didn't get through all of these five. You can read them on your own, and then you can see if.
Don't we still have one more class?
We have one more. We have one more, but we still haven't gotten to Nagarjuna.
We don't talk next class at all.
Maybe to get through, at least for these, yeah, maybe no questions, just to go through and see if you can get this, because
we have one sentence of Nagarjuna in this class about departing.
Okay, but I really do also appreciate all these examples, because I think this is where Madhyamaka really comes alive,
yeah,
is when we bring up all how it actually is in our experience and try to refute it. Like you said, I have some faith in it, but we shouldn't leave it at faith. That's the thing about this. Just like the monster under the bed. Thank you, devoted contemplators. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow.